Okay, I guess we're going to go ahead and get started. My name is Michael Ware. I'm from the Brooklyn branch of the ISO. And I'll be chairing this panel on the occupation of Iraq. Thank you very much. The war on and occupation of Iraq has become obviously a central political question of the day, just because it's impacted the entire world. We've seen it go from things like the weapons of mass destruction, shock and awe, the mission accomplished, failure of the media to really to take on all of Bush's lies, the corporate plunder of Iraq, the rise of the resistance, the systematic torture of people in prisons like Abu Ghraib, and this on top of what already happened in the 91 Gulf War and then 12 years of deadly sanctions. But of course, democracy is just around the corner with the transfer of power on June 30th, so I guess all will be taken care of. But somehow I think that's not going to be the case, and that's what I think our speakers are going to get to. We're lucky today to have with us two speakers. The first is Rania Masri, who is no stranger to these conferences. She has a long list of credentials. She is a fellow at the Institute for Southern Studies. She's written and published books such as Iraq, Its History, People and Politics. She contributed to Iraq Under Siege, as well as The Struggle for Palestine, both of which are available at Haymarket Books. This article, The Corporate Invasion of Iraq, featured in the ISR, available at the back of the room as well. And she's also produced a newly released documentary called About Baghdad. And the trailer will be shown here tomorrow. There's also CDs available with the music of the film. So, please welcome Rania Masri.
Thank you. I was just remarking how it's good to be short because this works, but this doesn't. So, in case y'all don't hear me, well. I'm sure you can hear me even without the microphone. And is anybody else in here cold, or is it just the Southerners? Okay. That makes me feel better. So we're supposed to be really happy because, what, in a week, it's all going to be over? June 30th, you know, democracy, good transfer of sovereignty, economic health to the country, our troops come home. Okay, so it was a bad war, but good things come out of bad things, right? Not quite, and we all know not quite. What I want to do, just in the short time that I have with you to talk, is to go through some of the major problems that we have right now that unfortunately aren't being discussed enough, neither, of course, by the U.S. corporate press, nor, unfortunately, by ourselves and by the anti-war movement. And that is specifically the full tentacles of this occupation, the full tentacles of the military occupation. And then I'm going to conclude it by talking about, you know, our favorite topic, which is the war profiteering and the kind of corporations that are getting taxpayer money and the amazing things, truly amazing things, they're doing with the taxpayer money. So the latest news that came out in The Guardian is, did you all hear about that two 2,000-pound bombs that, remember, they tried to kill Saddam Hussein with back early last year? And we heard that that was just the one incident that they used, the two 2,000-pound bombs. And, of course, Saddam Hussein wasn't there. And, oops, sorry, they attacked a restaurant. Civilians were killed. Just released in The Guardian that they conducted 50 such targeted assassinations using such weaponry in Iraq, all of which missed their target. So it would have been bad had they achieved their target anyway, because it's illegal for them to do what they did. But it makes it even worse that they miss their target every time. 50 airstrikes using that kind of weaponry miss their target. And it's just one example, and I could talk to you at length about the kind of human rights violations the military, from the start of the invasion until now, have committed under the screen of the U.S. media, under the screen of the U.S. media, that rarely get talked about. We know what does get talked about, but what doesn't get talked about is typically much worse than we actually hear about. So there's that whole aspect of the military occupation. But to me personally, what's a lot more damaging than the military occupation per se that we can see and hear is the economic occupation. It's just like comparing the military occupation to the sanctions. The sanctions were much more deadly on the human population in Iraq than the military occupation arguably could ever be. the sanctions themselves, 13 years of which killed, conservatively speaking, 500,000 Iraqi children under the age of 5. Conservatively speaking. No bombs, no weaponry, no memorial for these children, no mass graves for these children, and right now, nobody talks about the sanctions. Similarly speaking, when we talk so much about the military occupation, but we don't talk about the economic occupation that has been undergoing in Iraq for the past year, even though the economic occupation arguably is a lot deadlier than the military occupation because it strips people of their livelihood, of their means to purchase food, to purchase medicine, to go to school, to go to college, and therefore really destroys their lives much more than a targeted killing here and a mass killing of a family here. Much more. And when we look at what has happened in Iraq with regards to the economic structural changes that have taken place over this past year, they're not insignificant. The kinds of things that Paul Bremer has undergone openly, and I have to say this is the only good thing about having a Republican in office. To me, the major difference between a Republican and a Democrat, Republicans just tell us what they're doing. Democrats, we have to figure it out. Typically, that's the main difference. So briefly, here is what Bremer has succeeded in doing openly. First, he told us that restructuring the Iraqi economy is the main objective in Iraq. Okay, now to me, it's not a discussion now of whether privatization is a good or bad thing. I mean, I argue it's a bad thing. But I also argue that whether or not it's a bad thing is actually secondary. Because what's more important is that the people who are affected by that decision get a choice in making that decision, have an impact into that decision. But what we have had happen in Iraq over this past year is that Paul Bremer alone, not even with the U.S.-appointed 25 Iraqi governing council members, most of whom are Iraqi exiles from the rich communities around the world who don't even represent Iraqis, but without even their support. I mean, when you don't even have the support of the appointed people, you know it's bad. So what did he do? The first thing he did is he removed tariffs, removed domestic subsidies in Iraq. Thereby, just by doing this, he destroyed the poultry system in Iraq and he destroyed the textile industry in Iraq within a few months, just by removing tariffs, which barely got any discussion in the U.S. press. And then he imposed a 15% flat tax in Iraq for individuals and for corporations. But if you happen to be a corporation that is receiving money from U.S. taxpayers to conduct, so to speak, reconstruction, you don't have to pay any taxes. Completely, you know, because I know the tax havens that they build in the Cayman Islands aren't enough for them. We need to give them additional tax havens. And then there was the order that you all may have heard about, which is Order 39. How many people here heard about Order 39? Wow. Well, then it's an order that you all needed to have heard about, actually. This passed in September. And it's Order 39 that the occupation authorities themselves refer to as the Foreign Direct Investment Law. And it, in and of itself, is the most destructive law that Paul Bremer has passed. Arguably, it's the most destructive thing that the U.S. military has done to Iraq this past year. What this law states is two parts. One, any, I stress this, any foreign individual or corporation now has the right to own 100% of any aspect of the Iraqi economic sector, with the exception of oil, because that's kind of been controlled. Okay, notice they did not exclude water. They did not exclude other natural resources. They just set aside oil. So one, any foreign individual or corporation can own 100% of any aspect of the Iraqi economic sector with the exception of oil. Two, as if that weren't bad enough. Okay, two, and no one, not even those who still believe in free trade economics and shock therapy could argue this one, that this is good for any economy. Two, that those individuals can then remove 100% of their profits out of the country, quote, without delay. I mean, when we look at this, we've seen examples of this in Puerto Rico. They passed similar laws in Puerto Rico. They've passed similar laws, you know, arguably in numerous other aspects of the world that have been occupied, but none to this blatant black and white degree. This basically just openly reads, we're going to come in and plunder your country. Openly. I mean, there's no discussion about this. No one can argue that this is for the investment of Iraqis because we're going to remove all the profits immediately, anytime we so wish. Now, ironically, at the same time that Paul Bremer was passing all these laws without consultation with Iraqis, he also decided that, you know, there was one law that he couldn't change in Iraq because he felt that the Iraqis themselves should be involved in this process. of changing this law. He did not want to supersede his authority. And that law was the law that would overturn a law that Saddam Hussein passed, which is a law that states that if you happen to work in a state-sponsored economy, state-sponsored industry, which is the majority of jobs in Iraq, you do not have the right to strike or unionize. And Paul Bremer decided that it's not quite in his authority to change that law without consultation with Iraqis. So that law still holds. Everything else, he had the right to change as he saw it. Okay, now what makes all this really problematic for us is on top of all this, we have a small aspect. We know that these laws are illegal. Okay, they're a fact, they're illegal because an occupation has no right to transform the land and the community it is occupying. And this is clearly a transformation. And so that's one of the reasons, not the only one, but one of the reasons that U.S. companies and other companies haven't been getting insurance to go into Iraq. Because the insurance companies are going, you know, the Iraqis could elect a government that would nationalize or change these laws, and we don't have an ability to protect you because the laws aren't valid. Unless we have a government that has international legitimacy, and then the laws are valid. Come June 30th, with this government that has been granted international legitimacy by an organization that it itself stated that the invasion was wrong and the occupation was wrong, but those men and women that the occupation decided to run the country, somehow they're all right. And that organization is the United Nations. I mean, it astounds me how they could go through this logic. Okay, so now that we have this, so to speak, interim government in Iraq that has basically been granted legitimacy by the United Nations, it means two things. Now this government can get aid, quote unquote, from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And we know how good those two organizations are. You know? And on top of that, they can put a stamp of approval to these illegal laws, which would open the road for insurance, it would open the road for numerous other things to happen in Iraq, to add on to that. Now, just in case that the appointed men, okay, aren't completely in the hands of the government, the U.S. government, the United States made it clear that, one, this interim government has no authority to change any of the laws passed before it. Okay? It has no authority to change any of the contracts made before it. And it has no authority, get this, it has no authority to make any changes in Iraq that are long-term, because long-term changes cannot be made until we have an elected government that will take power, and an elected government cannot take power until December 2005. If we consider how much shit Paul Bremer has imposed on Iraq in 1 year, and now we're going to wait from June 30th, 2004, till December 2005 to sit on our butts to wait for more before this government can have any lawmaking authority that will have long-term consequence. And this government, let me stress, is an appointed government anyway. So the U.S. occupation appoints a government, and then it does not even trust its appointees. So it handshackles them so that even its appointees cannot make laws, cannot change laws. And this is all within economic restructuring, and this is huge. And we're not really talking about this. I mean, this is really fundamental. This goes into employment. It goes into the basic thing about, well, how do we use oil revenues? How are we going to use oil revenues? It goes into a very simple thing that, again, we're not just talking about. There is a ministry right now among the ministries in Iraq that has been declared financially independent, which means it's up to this ministry to raise its own funds. Okay. It's the Ministry of Health. The Ministry of Health. So it's up to the Ministry of Health to raise its own funds to destroy, to rebuild the most destroyed infrastructure in Iraq. How in God's name is this possible? So now the Ministry of Health is imposing, among other things, pharmaceutical fees, which basically means when you go to the pharmacy and you want some drugs, they have a tax that you will pay. It's a regressive taxation on people who are lucky enough to be able to afford the drugs in the first place, to help pay for those who can't afford it at all. And it's insufficient financially. And it speaks volumes that the Coalition Provisional Authority declared the Ministry of Health to be financially independent. It speaks volumes about their priorities. And then they have the audacity in the 2004 budget to declare that they want to create a safety net for the poor. and at the same time to declare that by the end of 2005, there will be full privatization of all state-sponsored and state-endorsed work. To me, there's a contradiction in that. There's a contradiction that even Republicans in this country wouldn't dare make. It's quite extensive. And it's a discussion that we are not talking about here. Not enough. We're not raising that banner enough. Nor are we raising the banner enough about who right now has been appointed. And I have to say, I never thought I would come to the day that I would actually say, Ahmed Chalabi looks good. I never thought I could ever say that a convicted felon, a well-known liar, a man who left Iraq when he was 13 and then had the audacity to represent Iraqis, that he actually looks good. Because when I compare him to the so-called Iraqi prime minister, and by the way, anytime we allow these men to be quoted and represented according to these titles, it's a disgrace and it's an offense. To call Iyad Alawi the Iraqi prime minister, I think, is just deeply offensive. It's equivalent to calling Saddam Hussein the president. It's equivalent to calling, almost as bad. You all know where I'm going. Almost as bad. It speaks volumes that Condoleezza Rice herself said, these are not America's puppets. This is a terrific list, a really good government, and we're very pleased with the names that emerged. They emerged, these names. It stuns me. And then George Bush had the audacity that, when he brought the Alawi to the G8 summit, to welcome him as the choice of the Iraqi people. We appoint you, and then somehow you're the choice of the Iraqi people. Briefly, who is Iyad al-Alawi? We know for a fact that he used to work with the CIA. We know for a fact that he used to work with the MI6. So he beat Saddam Hussein on that factor.
He was a spy.
Yeah, we're getting there.
I'm Iraqi. I know that.
We know that Saddam Hussein was affiliated with one intelligence agency. Iyad Alawi beats him. He's affiliated with two. And then it goes beyond that, because Iyad Alawi himself was a former Ba'athist. A former Ba'athist who, when he left the Ba'ath Party to work with these two intelligence organizations, did something very well known that has been published in British papers, which is he himself orchestrated terrorist bombings in 1995, one on a school bus and one in a cinema in Baghdad. Okay, and then now he has the audacity to say, I will stop bombs in Iraq. It takes a bomb maker to stop bombs. It's ridiculous. So one, we know that he's affiliated with two intelligence organizations. One, we know he's a former Ba'athist. And all this talk about not having former Ba'athists, somehow they've forgotten it. Three, we know he is legally speaking a terrorist. Not rhetorically speaking, legally speaking a terrorist. And four, we know he's a liar. And I don't mean that just, as rhetoric. I mean, we know he's a liar because he was responsible for the 45-minute weapons of mass destruction claim that was very popular in Britain, that you may have heard of here, which is, quote, that Saddam's regime could fire germ warfare missiles as far as Cyprus within 45 minutes of giving the order. Pure garbage. It was actually what one New York spokesperson himself acknowledged was, quote, a crock of shit. That's his words. Okay, so we know all these things, and then on top of that, we actually have a human rights campaigner himself who says, quote, I think he will succeed in creating not a fully democratic state, which in my opinion you either are or you aren't, okay, but something on the model of Jordan or Egypt. Bless his heart. That's all we wanted in the Arab world was another Egypt that has already been in a state of, military, when you have, what's the word in English? When you declare military rule in a martial law, thank you. It's been in a state of martial law ever since Hosni Mubarak came into office as president. It's been a state of martial law. So it's not quite the democratic model we aspire to. Okay, and this is clearly who Iyad Alawi is. And he is the person with the power and not necessarily the, so to speak, president. Actually, he's not the person with the power. The person with the power is Negroponte, who's another really wonderful man who got the job, I think, because Henry Kissinger was busy that day, considering the people that George Bush has been choosing. When we look at then who are the ministers underneath Iyad al-Alawi, we see that a large portion of them are exiles, significant exiles. Some of them have U.S. citizenship, some of them have British citizenship, some of them have French citizenship. Some of them have clear plans to return to their works in Cambridge and Chicago when their work in Iraq is over. These aren't people, you know, who are... I mean, imagine if I'd run for office in this country and say, and if I don't get it, I'll just go back to Beirut. It's not quite the kind of representative that, you know, any community would want. And these are the ministers. These are who we have right now, allegedly representing the country. And then, in case some of us are still optimistic, or more specifically, what do we say when we are greeted with people who are grossly optimistic, who then say, but we're going to have elections in 2005. Isn't that great? And we say, fantastic, we have a year to rig the elections in Iraq. We have a year to declare who will be allowed to run for elections and who won't be. And we have a year to declare who will be left alive to run for elections and who won't be. And we have a year to declare what will be left of Iraq if we ever do actually have a democracy. So assuming the best of all circumstances, assuming we actually get a democracy, a real democracy, where poor people's vote counts as much as a rich man's vote. I mean, a real democracy, okay? Assuming we get that and they come to power December 2005, if Paul Bremer's plans continue with the speed that they are continuing, they may, arguably, be very little left of Iraq for a democratic government to represent. And I don't mean that in rhetoric. I mean it because already one of the appointed Iraqi ministers, who I am, you know, ashamed to say as a woman is a woman, one of the appointed Iraqi ministers is having open discussions with a British company to discuss the privatization of water in Iraq. This is one example. So once water is privatized, and then come 2005, 2006, the government gets in place, and the government goes, y'all, we don't like this. We're going to claim our water, nationalize it. We know what the U.S. does when a government nationalizes things. We know the kind of uproar that happens. And we know the kind of support that a government needs before it can undertake that. And we know the probability that any Iraqi government will have that support is next to nil. So what is happening right now is building extreme obstacles in the face of Iraqi sovereignty, the real kind of sovereignty. And this goes beyond a military occupation. This goes beyond 14 permanent military bases that are being built right now in Iraq. It takes it to the next level. And this is why we have to be talking, one, about the economic occupation that's happening, and two, about the lack of democracy and the way that this government will be presented to us in July as the government in Iraq. We need to be facing these head on and really confronting them beyond taking the slogan to bring them home. And once we do all that, then there's some fun things we can do here at home, which I just think are just amazing. Because truly, I can't believe the kind of crap that the companies that have U.S. contracts are doing. I mean, it takes it to a whole new level. Briefly, we have 10 contractors in Iraq that have been penalized $300 million in the past 4 years. So this isn't a small sum. And the way that they got away with getting these contracts is because the Bush administration repealed regulations put in place by the Clinton administration, which was one of the few good things that Clinton did before he left office, is he made a law that would not have allowed government work for companies convicted or penalized during the previous 3 years. 3 years, it's not bad. I mean, you know, when you go bankrupt, you lose your credit for what, 5 to 7 years. So here's just 3 years. That was one of the first things that Bush overturned when he got to office in one of his first few months. And then he gave these contracts out. Halliburton paid $2 million in 2002 to settle charges at inflated cost. Bechtel paid $110,000 to the EPA, and on, and they got contracts. And now we know some of the stuff that Halliburton has done, but really Halliburton takes it to the extreme. We know they've overcharged us on gasoline cost. We know they attempted to bill us on food that they never served to the military. Okay. On top of that, we know that they tried to bribe, they succeeded in bribing Kuwaitis to give them a subcontract. On top of that, do you know that they bill taxpayers $45 for a pack of soda and $100 for a bag of laundry? Do you know that Halliburton, a third of the trucks that Halliburton drives in Iraq, are empty, completely empty? So here we have an offense, one to the taxpayers, one to the drivers, okay, of these trucks who go back and forth risking their lives for nothing. I mean, literally nothing, okay? And then we have an offense for the soldiers who are waiting to get literally nothing. And then we have an offense that all of this is happening in Iraq at a time when we're being told we're building the country on literally nothing. Empty trucks, a third of them. Why? Because Halliburton gets paid a percentage on top of all its costs. You know what Halliburton does when its $80,000 trucks get a flat tire? They burn the truck and buy a new one and present that as cost. I mean, I get a flat tire. I don't burn the truck. So it's really quite spectacular. On top of all this then, because it's just not enough, on top of all this, we have this problem of private contractors in Iraq, which is the second largest army in Iraq, are the private contractors. We have 135,000 American soldiers, sorry, U.S. soldiers. I'm trying to find another word other than American. If anyone has any ideas, because I can't say United States, yin, I'd really love to hear them. So we have 135,000 soldiers from the U.S. and Puerto Rico. And then we have 20,000 private soldiers accountable to no one. And then we have the British Army, and then we have, you know, hundreds from this country, hundreds from that country. And we know that these private military contractors have been, you know, are among those specifically involved in the Abu Ghraib torture scandal. We don't know how many of them are involved in other torture scandals. And by the way, Abu Ghraib is not a prison. The men and women tortured in Abu Ghraib are not prisoners. To be a prisoner, you have to undergo a trial. They are detainees. And there's a big difference between the two, and we have to watch our language. And in case any time you hear anyone says prison, you stop them, you go, detention, not a prison. Huge difference. 90% of the men and women in Abu Ghraib, according to the military, were held by mistake. By mistake. Okay, so that, I think, says it all. So we have these private military contractors. These private military contractors, they're the ones that guard Paul Bremer. They're the ones that guard Halliburton and Bechtel and all the other groups. And now there's a company based in London called Aegis that has received an extremely lucrative contract to coordinate among all the military contractors. And this company has zero experience doing any of this work. Zero. Can you say political reasons for getting this contract? And again, what's happened is that we have an additional contract given to private military contractors out of either American money or Iraqi money, but given now when we have a government that's going to come into place allegedly in a week, and now this government cannot have the authority to change this contract given out to this private military contractor. I mean, it's amazing. So there's all these different levels of what's happening in Iraq that go beyond the military occupation. There's the level about what's happening with the relationship to American taxpayers, the way that our money is literally being stolen to just being sent to the rich elite. I mean, it's not really doing anything else. Okay? And then there is the crux of the issue of the way the Iraqi economy is being restructured, again, not to benefit the United States, but to benefit the corporations that get public subsidies already, that are given this even greater public subsidy called the occupation of Iraq, to benefit all on the backs of the people that have suffered a regime that we brought to power, Iraq-Iran war, the Gulf War, 13 years of sanctions, and then the invasion. How much more can a people withstand? And I have to say it in all honesty, every time I hear that the Iraqis are merely surviving, are merely resisting, are merely fighting right now in Iraq, are merely continuing to work, I am impressed that they are still there. And so long as they are struggling, given the 35 years of brutality that this country supported against them, then we get our hope from them and we continue our struggle here to make sure, not that Bush gets out of office, but that Bushism gets out of office. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Karee Peterson-Smith. Karee is a member of the ISO in Rochester, as well as a member of the Campus Anti-War Network, and he recently visited Iraq in January of 2004. Karee.
Thanks. What I hope to do
is draw out some of the lessons of the past year of this occupation of Iraq, and also lay out some of the challenges that I think our movement against the occupation faces. So to begin with, essentially and unfortunately, the things that the anti-war movement said before the invasion have been proven correct. That this war and occupation did not liberate Iraqis, but rather brought about further death and destruction. We all remember, and I suppose you could say that the invasion ended and the occupation began, with that famous image that we all saw again and again and again, the toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein in Firdevs Square in Baghdad. And they were hoping that this would be the image that would define the invasion and occupation of Iraq, the toppling of this statue. One less reported incident or image that took place during that toppling was that as U.S. troops put the cables around the neck of Saddam Hussein, of the statue, to begin to pull him down, one soldier climbed on top of the body of the statue and placed an American flag over the face of Saddam Hussein. And he was told to take it down, because perhaps the imagery was too strong of a dictatorship with an American face. But that imagery, I think, is a harbinger of what was to come, exactly that, a dictatorship with an American face. So a year after the declaration of major combat operations being over, you remember when that other great image of the war when Bush put on his flight suit and flew onto the aircraft carrier. Mission accomplished, right? A year later, this May 1st, of course, International Workers' Day, Bush, in his weekly radio address, said that despite the problems in Iraq that Iraqis still face, life for Iraqis is a world away from what it was under Saddam Hussein's regime when they disappeared into political prisons and torture chambers. And the irony, of course, is that he said this in the same week that the images which do define the occupation, I think, for the world came to light. And I'm speaking, of course, of the images of U.S. troops torturing detainees in Abu Ghraib detention center in Iraq. Now, I think this exposed a glimpse of some of the brutality of the occupation to the world, and by the way, turned millions of people in this country against the occupation of Iraq. I think that when people in this country saw the reality of what the U.S. does abroad, it turns their stomachs, and they turn against this occupation. Now, I said, though, that we got a glimpse of some of the brutality, and that glimpse really wasn't adequate at all. That is, the discussion that's about the Abu Ghraib torture, the discussion by the government and the government's and the media, the corporate media, is really incredibly narrow. First of all, the fact that it's referred to as the Abu Ghraib prison abuse scandal. The prison abuse scandal. It's not abuse, it's torture. And it's not a scandal, it's a crime against humanity. Furthermore, it's not just a few bad apples, as they claimed, that what, the eight morons who lost the war or whatever. Not only does it go all the way up the chain of command in terms of responsibility, it comes straight from the people who actually run this occupation, the Bushes and the Cheneys, and the people in this government, but also it's the logical conclusion of a war and occupation. That is, the dehumanization of Iraqi people is necessary. U.S. troops are bombarded with this racism to dehumanize Iraqis so that they can do exactly, so that they can kill and occupy the country. And I think that torture is the logical conclusion of occupation, and I can't think of a single colonial occupation of the 20th century that didn't involve torture. Furthermore, the remedies that are proposed to address the problems really obviously skirt the issue. First of all, the idea that the U.S. should destroy Abu Ghraib. President Bush announced that Abu Ghraib should be destroyed, and that a new detention center should be built instead. And so when we drove to Baghdad, Abu Ghraib is right on the road. You can see it right next to the highway, and what Bush wants in Iraq is what exists in the United States, that is, the hidden detention centers all across this country. I'm sure that I passed many on my way from Rochester, Chicago, through the backwoods of New York, Ohio, and Indiana. Furthermore, what this really is about is that they couldn't stomach the irony in the imagery that the most notorious prison under Saddam Hussein was now the most notorious detention center in the world under the U.S. occupation. The key thing, though, is that no one in reference to this, the torture in Abu Ghraib, is talking about the key question, which is the occupation of Iraq itself. No one is talking about why these detainees got into the detention center to begin with. The fact that they're going into neighborhoods and rounding up men, women, and children by the thousands and taking them into detention centers like this. And no one's talking about the fact that the U.S. shouldn't be there anyway. And this is a job for the anti-war movement to do. One of the lessons, moving on to some other lessons to draw out over the past year, I think that one of them is regarding the role that the United Nations has played before the invasion and during the occupation. And I think that this is really important. The UN and the countries like France and Germany who opposed the invasion. Now, there were people in the anti-war movement who may have looked to France and Germany as opponents of the invasion. And I think that part of that was the pressure of freedom fries and all the, you remember that? All the stupid, demonization of the French for, daring to challenge the United States. I think that the French and German opposition had much more to do with French and German imperial interests, the fact that they were being cut out of the deal and had, nothing to do with the idea that Jacques Chirac, who's a right-winger, has any humanity or concern for Iraqi people. But also, in terms of the United Nations, I think that there were people in our movement who hoped, and I think for all the right reasons, looked to the UN to make some kind of divine intervention and prevent the invasion from happening. That was one of the messages in the demonstrations that preceded the invasion of Iraq. And I think it's important to look at what actually happened. That instead of preventing the invasion from happening, which I don't see how the UN could do anyway, but that didn't happen. Furthermore, there was no protest once the invasion happened. I mean, it's my understanding, and someone correct me if I'm wrong, that not so much as a resolution was passed against an unprovoked, illegal invasion. Furthermore, after being circumvented, that is, first they went to the UN, and then when they realized they couldn't get a stamp of approval, they just went around the UN and ruled it irrelevant. After being circumvented, after being lied to, remember when Colin Powell showed them cartoons about, mobile weapons labs or whatever? After all of that, the UN was still able to be brought on to clean up the mess that the United States made and legitimize it. So UN envoy Lakhdar Brahimi conducted a fact-finding mission earlier this year in January and February on the subject of whether or not Iraq could hold elections. And the conclusion was no, that Iraq wasn't ready. Essentially, Iraq isn't ready for democracy. Now, Brahimi can get up and say that and get away with it, whereas Bush can't. Bush can't get up and say Iraqis aren't ready for democracy, but the UN has the stamp of legitimacy so that it can. So essentially, we have the UN acting as the PR agency of the United States. Furthermore, during the worst, the whole thing is a crime, but some of the worst moments of the invasion and occupation, the UN was silent. So during the siege of Fallujah, I emailed this woman named Iman. She heads up a group called Occupation Watch based in Baghdad that everyone should check out, occupationwatch.org. And I emailed her and asked, do you think that a UN occupation would be better than a US occupation? I want to know what you think. And this was during the siege of Fallujah and during an all-out repression of the resistance in Iraq. And her response to me was kind of frantic. There's a certain desperation. Her response was, the UN has to do something. It can't just sit by. And it did sit by. There was no resolution against what the U.S. was doing in Fallujah. There was no protest against the siege of Fallujah. Now, I say these things. And then of course, we have the latest stamp of approval that Rania mentioned. The Security Council votes unanimously to support the transfer of sovereignty and actually legitimize the whole project to begin with, because if you legitimize the outcome, then you legitimize the invasion and the occupation. Now, I say these things not to bash the UN, but to draw a lesson that I think that our movement, we can't rely on the UN to stop this invasion or stop the occupation. I think that that's actually our job, and that at best, at times, the UN was silent when it should have been, vocal, and at worst times, it actually was part of the problem, I think. And I think that that's something that we should talk about in our movement. I think that we have to rely on the ordinary people in the United States and in Iraq and around the world. I think that's the force that's going to actually work against this occupation. Now, another lesson that I think we have to draw out, we know about all the lies that were used to sell the war. It's been proven again this week, as it had to be proven, that there were no connections between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, though Condoleezza Rice says there really are. And there were no weapons of mass destruction found, of course, and not that anyone's talking about that anymore. I guess that's old news. One of the lies that I don't think we're talking about enough, but I think we really have to draw out, is the fact that people in this country, we were told that we would actually benefit from this invasion and occupation, and that's absolutely not true. the idea was that we would get freer, we'd get more freedom as a result of what the U.S. was doing in Iraq, and that actually our lifestyle would benefit as well. And I think that there are people, even in the anti-war movement, who are saying, you know, the reason why the U.S. does what it does around the world is because it has to provide for the lifestyle that we actually live here in the United States. Thank you. And first of all, our lifestyle hasn't improved, as billions of dollars have been stolen from our education system and our social services. We haven't gotten any freer. In fact, the war on terror abroad has been used as a justification for a war of terror here in the United States, the rounding up of Arabs and Muslims and political dissidents. And so we haven't gotten any freer. And even the idea that the U.S. does what it does in the Middle East for the sake of keeping our gas prices low. Those of you who drove to Chicago like I did know that gas prices have actually gone up since last year. So that wasn't even true. Furthermore, of course, people from this country have lost in terms of the women and men of this country who are in the U.S. military. We have hundreds who have died, who have been killed, and thousands who have been injured. And I, like perhaps millions of people around this country, had been involved in the strange ritual of checking the New York Times section, the names of the dead, looking for my cousin, who was sent to Baghdad as I was leaving Baghdad. Thankfully, he came back, but we know that a lot of people aren't coming back. And so that's a ritual that millions of people in this country are actually engaging in right now, as their loved ones are abroad fighting, dying, and killing for oil and empire. However, because of the contradictions within the U.S. military, that is, we have working class kids my age, disproportionately black and Latino from the cities of this country, and from the rural areas of this country, who essentially have no future in there, and you know, there's no job prospects or anything like that. And they're sucked into what we call the poverty draft, that is, people join the military because that's their only option. But you have working class kids and actually adults who are fighting for the oil and the empire, for the people who run this country. Because of those contradictions, there has been a resistance that's developing within the military. And that's something that I think is incredibly significant and something that we should be proud of. And developments like Military Families Speak Out, where we have family members of soldiers serving in Iraq, is a huge deal. And actually, we also see the beginnings of opposition within Iraq itself among U.S. troops. And I don't have too much time to go into it, but a story that I like to share is that I got to visit the Green Zone when I was in Baghdad, and people may have heard of the Green Zone because it gets bombed like every other week. It's where Paul Bremer III lives in one of Saddam's old palaces. It's the headquarters of the U.S. occupation forces in Baghdad, and it's heavily fortified. So there's concrete blocks everywhere, and tanks, and machine gun nests, and barbed wire, and tons of U.S. troops. And so on one of these big concrete blocks when I was there, I saw the letters FTA written. FTA stands for Fuck the Army. It was the slogan of resistance within the military during the Vietnam War. And the fact that this is showing up in Iraq already, you know, after 6 months or so of occupation, is significant. Not to overstate it, but it shows that there are contradictions even within the military that's occupying Iraq. Okay, so I think that a silver lining for this horror, or I guess the hope of the horror, another thing that many of us in the anti-war movement were saying last year is that imperialism breeds anti-imperialism, that occupation is going to breed resistance. And like Rania said, I think it's incredibly inspiring that after 35 years of brutal dictatorship backed by the United States, after 20 years of siege, after the horror of the invasion, shock and awe, after all of that, Iraqis are not only surviving and enduring, but resisting this occupation. And the depth of the resistance is much broader than what we're told, you know, in the mainstream media. It involves resistance within the labor movement, resistance among women's groups, socialists, student groups, and, of course, the armed resistance. They're resisting not for the reasons that we're told, that they're Saddam loyalists or foreign fighters or whatever. Or, by the way, largely they're not resisting because they're principled anti-imperialists. They're resisting because they've seen the brutality of the occupation, and it's forcing them to resist the occupation. Everyone should see the movie, the documentary that Rania helped make called About Baghdad. It's the whole thing is interviews with ordinary Iraqis who live in Baghdad. And one of the themes that you gather is this incredible patience of people who are saying, okay, they got rid of Saddam Hussein, and We'll see how this goes. This documentary was made 3 months after the invasion. When I was there in January, that patient's, you could see in the documentary, the patient's wearing thin. When I was there, it was definitely wearing thin. And I spoke with, thank you, I spoke with a man named Tariq. He was actually our driver from Amman, Jordan, to Baghdad. And he told me about some of the horrors of life during the invasion and the occupation. He told me, you know, Iraqis won't take this for long. We are here, but we'll be here. And I didn't get it at first. But he did again. We're here. We'll be here. And then finally I got it. I said, you'll rise up. And he said, yeah, we're going to rise up. And a few months later, we saw this mass uprising across the country. So the resistance, by the way, is not just followers. We're being told that they're either regime remnants following Saddam Hussein, that they're being, the strings are being pulled by foreign fighters, or that they're... there's like a seven-word phrase. It's followers of radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. you know, that they're probably, but actually, among the people opposing and resisting the occupation, there's diversity of politics and opinion, and there's a discussion in Iraq about what it's going to take to actually liberate Iraq and what kind of Iraqis Iraqis want. So there's diversity in that discussion. Okay, in terms of challenges for our movement, first of all, in terms of Iraqi resistance, I think that our movement has to support the right of Iraqis to resist. And I think that that means confronting the logic that the people who run this occupation use to explain the resistance. You know, the resistance fighters are called evildoers, enemies of civilization, bad guys, all this stuff. I mean, and it's challenged their ridiculous logic. General Mark Kimmett, who's actually a spokesperson for the occupation in Baghdad, he said, I was listening to National Public Radio, and he was talking about the Mahdi Army, Sadr's group. And he said, well, this is an illegal militia, and therefore we have the right to hunt them down. Like as if the occupation is legal, right? we have to challenge this ridiculous logic. And we have to point out the truth about why Iraqis actually are resisting. That is the brutality of being occupied by a foreign power. And actually, people in the United States, you can't tell me that if Texas was being occupied by Syria or whoever, that they wouldn't resist either. Now, this does not mean that we have to get behind attacks like the bombings that kill all these civilians, or like the horrific incident that people may have heard about today, where this contractor for Lockheed was beheaded in Saudi Arabia. But I think that it's first of all, in Iraq, there's actually a discussion over tactics, over what tactics it's going to take to win liberation, over what is resistance and what is terrorism. But I think it's instructive too that after these horrific bombings that kill lots of civilians, like the one earlier this week, right after the bombing, there was a demonstration. Thank you. There was a demonstration against the occupation. That is, Iraqis drawing the conclusion that the U.S. presence in Iraq is not preventing chaos, it's actually the cause of this chaos. Secondly, in terms of the beheading that we heard about today, it's horrific. That's something we don't have to get behind. But the racism that comes out afterward, that is, the media and the government use these incidents and say, see, this is why these people are savages. And just to read from today's Chicago Tribune, which I'm told is the liberal newspaper in Chicago. This isn't like the right-wing one. This is the editorial is called The Murder of an American, and just to... I won't subject you to the whole thing, but terrorists across the Middle East have declared war on the free world, and they take special pleasure in slaughtering innocent civilians. I mean, this kind of racism is something that we actually absolutely have to challenge, and if that wasn't enough, here are a couple of political cartoons that you can pass around. These were in today's Chicago Tribune, and you can see the kind of disgusting racism that they're using. And that's the kind of thing that we have to challenge in terms of supporting the right of Iraqis to resist. Another challenge of our movement is exactly that, confronting the racism that they use to legitimize this occupation. Because the whole idea is that brown people can't rule themselves, and therefore we need George W. Bush, who wasn't elected, if I recall, to go abroad and teach democracy. It's ludicrous. Secondly, we have to take up the matter of Palestine. We have to take up the cause of justice for Palestine. The racism that is being used against Iraqi people, and especially Iraqis who dare challenge the occupation of Iraq, has been used 100-fold against Palestinian people, who we are told are a bunch of people who don't value their lives, and that's why they send their children to go off and die and kill other people in the process. In terms of the connections between the occupations of Iraq and Palestine, if there's any doubt, before this year, we see that Israeli army officers are actually training U.S. troops in how to occupy Iraq because they perfected the tactics in Palestine. We see M-16s and Apache helicopters and Abrams tanks and Caterpillar bulldozers being used in both the occupations of Iraq and of Palestine, both all from the United States, made in the USA. And the siege of Fallujah looked eerily like the siege of Jenin, almost exactly 2 years that preceded it. And so these things are connected. They're not exactly the same, but they're both part of what the U.S. is doing to reshape the Middle East, not only politically, but, you know, as Ronnie was saying, in terms of the privatization of Iraq, the biggest economy in the Middle East, of course, is Israel, and that'll have certain repercussions for that. Lastly, in terms of challenges for our movement, we know that this is an election year, and all politics is being kind of funneled in that direction. We have two major candidates, both of whom are pro-occupation. The so-called opposition candidate wants to send 40,000 more troops to one-up Bush's 20,000. Either Bush or Kerry will be elected, presumably. I mean, no one was elected last time. But either one will become president. We have to build a movement that can organize regardless of which warmonger gets in office. And I think, too, we have to recognize the role that the Democratic Party and John Kerry are actually playing right now in terms of undermining the anti-war movement. And that's taking place in a lot of ways, but I know that people I'm meeting who are some of the best activists around who could be building the anti-war movement are instead campaigning for John Kerry, and the people I'm talking to who are doing that find that they disagree with Kerry on every single issue, but they feel the need to do this because of the whole logic of anybody but Bush. And that's something that we have to recognize and we have to challenge. In conclusion, the elections, in terms of showing where the Democratic Party stands, that they're actually just as much for the occupation of Iraq as the Republicans are, as well as the occupation itself, I think, is exposing this whole system. That is, war exposes, in all of its rawness and brutality, the system of capitalism and the mass destruction of it. And I think that more than ever, we need to build a left alternative to politics as usual in the United States. And I think that socialist politics has to be at the heart of that. The socialist politics of anti-imperialism, of anti-racism, of the right of nations to self-determination, to actually, you know, determine their own destiny, of anti-oppression, and of a class analysis that identifies who is fighting these wars and for whom. I think that these socialist politics are not somehow separate or removed from the movement against the occupation in Iraq. I think that they actually help to explain the reality of the occupation, that they provide a guide for action in terms of a way forward for that movement. And I think that at the core of this movement against the occupation, there needs to be a group of people who are organizing in the here and now, but also taking up the matter of ultimately challenging and uprooting the system that causes these wars and occupations, a system of profit.